The Aboriginal Dreamtime.
So these dreamings, you know, they stretch right across the landscape. And it's your cognition, your being, everything, your body, your understanding of the world, your way of governing, your way of living, your way of being a custodian of different bioregional ecosystems, all these things are sung into the landscape. And these stories interconnect like perfectly and give you a roadmap of how to live in the world, how to be.
That's scholar, Aboriginal clan member, and sustainability theorist, Tyson Yunkaporta. We spend the hour talking with him about his groundbreaking book, Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. That's coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. It's clear that Western thinking, with its emphasis on competition, dominion over and exploitation of the natural world, and enshrinement of hierarchy, isn't working. Indeed, it threatens our very existence. But isn't that human nature, that survival of the fittest way of thinking? Maybe not. In fact, for the vast majority of human existence, people didn't think that way. They thought of humans and the world we inhabit in relational terms, as Native Americans say, all my relations. When everything is part of your family, you take care of it. Native and Aboriginal cultures today have preserved that way of thinking. And it's well they have, because it might be just the kind of thinking we need. Author Tyson Yunkaporta straddles the two worldviews. He's a member of the Aboriginal Apalach clan in far north Queensland, Australia, who carves traditional tools and weapons, and he also works as a senior lecturer in Indigenous knowledges at Deakin University in Melbourne. His brilliant new book, Sand Talk, looks at global systems from an Indigenous perspective. He asks how contemporary life diverges from the pattern of creation. How does this affect us? How can we do things differently? How, in fact, can Indigenous thinking save the world? Well, Tyson Yunkaporta, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's really good to be here.
This is just such an amazing book, Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. When I read the title, I said, I must talk with the author because I think it was just maybe this year that it occurred to me that Indigenous thinking isn't only correct thinking or better thinking than what we have, but that it actually is the thinking that we need if we are going to save the world.
And
this book is as much about viewing civilization through Aboriginal eyes as about Aboriginal ways of being in the world. So I wonder if you could first just talk about that perspective, viewing civilization through Aboriginal eyes.
Yeah, well, it's one thing viewing it, but then reporting on what you view is another thing altogether, you know. You know, it's not the safest exercise in the world. So, like, you know, for example, you'd be safe to say, you know, everything you just said about Aboriginal knowledge, but I wouldn't necessarily be safe to say it like that. So I say it like, you know, oh, there might be some things in there that are of use. You know, there might be some stuff. Don't throw the baby over the bathwater. Have a little look. There might be something useful in there. And that's about as far as I can go because, you know, if I said the same thing you just said, you know, there'd be a lot of people who'd be like, you know, you hate white people or whatever, you know. So I don't know. It's a dangerous space, but it's also, you know, lovely. And there are so many people like yourself who just want to come in and sit alongside and you know, learn the things that are useful and share things back that they have of use as well. So for me, it has to be dialogue. It's got to be dialogical. You know, if anybody's just monologuing at you, then probably that's not the right knowledge.
Yeah, in fact, your whole point of view throughout this book is what you call us too. So first of all, tell us what do you mean by us too? That is T-W, us hyphen T-W-O. And then also talk about the many more personal pronouns in Aboriginal languages, and what does that say about the perspective?
It's, well, you know, you look at the languages, and I don't know, grammar's the most boring thing in the world and the most exciting thing at the same time, because the patterns in a person's grammar, in the grammar of a culture, kind of expresses a lot of their protocols and ways of being in the world, and a lot of their patterns, you know, of governance and sociality and what their worldview is, you know, how much are you connected with the landscape and being responsive to it? Or, you know, if you sever yourself from the landscape, then your grammar changes as well. So, you know, and I know the easiest place to start is pronouns. So that's where I start people, you know. What do the pronouns in your language tell you? So people always, they're like, you know, my name's Natalie. I'm Natalie, she, her, you know, like brackets pronouns after. And like if I'm in, you know, a conference or something and everyone's doing their pronouns. And so I comes to me and I'm, oh, I better do my pronoun. And I'm like, my name's Tyson. Nil Nunung is my pronouns. So, you know, in a lot of our Aboriginal languages, we don't have gendered pronouns at all. So I say nil nunung, and that means that could be he or she. It's the same, because we're not really focused on that. You know, we don't really have a lot of use for gendered pronouns. But that doesn't mean we have a lack either, because we have a lot more pronouns, especially personal pronouns, than English does. Because all those pronouns express your, especially the first person pronouns, they express your roles in the world, the social roles that you occupy in your ecosystem and in your society. One of which I'm ignoring right now. I don't know if you can hear my little girl crying for me out the door there.
I think I can.
See, she had a, she's only three, and I made her first fighting stick, like, traditional, like woman's fighting stick. And, you know, I don't know what I was thinking, because of course she's going to want to fight with it. So she's like stabbing her brother and that this morning with this stick, and I just took it off her. And she wants it back. So she's crying outside the door. But see, I mean, back to language, that if you ask anybody in Australia what that stick is, they'll say, oh, that's a women's digging stick. They call it a digging stick, and it's like it's been linguistically domesticated. So, you know, when Europeans came here, they kind of mapped this gendered understanding of what men and women are over the top of our culture. You know, and, oh, this is a hunter-gatherer society. So like the men over there, you're the hunters, and women over there, you're the gatherers. But that stick is not called in any of our languages. It wasn't called a digging stick. It's never been called a digging stick. You know, that's a woman's stick, and that's her like Swiss Army knife. She does everything with that. So she hunts with that. She uses it for a spear. Like this little girl was trying to spear her 1-year-old brother before. And you know, it's for spearing. It's for throwing, hunting, fighting primarily. If it was called anything, it's called a fighting stick. You know, it's for fighting and but also digging. But see, men used to use boomerangs for digging as well. I say used to because I've never seen anybody actually do that. But, you know, so boomerangs were for digging before, like men's, but nobody called them digging sticks. But it's only women's tools and weapons that were linguistically domesticated. Like, so language is very powerful. So you come in, and if you get rid of all of someone's pronouns, if they have a pronoun like they, if you've got like five different kinds of us, you know, five different categories of us, and you get rid of those, then you're getting rid of all of somebody's way of relating as a group. That's very powerful, isn't it?
Yes.
So you have us too, which you mentioned before, I tell you, I'm sorry, I come around a long way around to the answering the question, but it goes, so there's us two, like the two of us, like a pair, a kinship pair. And then there's like us, like an exclusive us, so us but not them. So an exclusive group. And then you've got us, like us all, you know, and then there's heaps of other like different finer things like us belonging to this person or this ancestor. Or this place. So, you know, us belonging to him, us belonging to them, us belonging to this, you know, there's lots of different things. And then there's like, you know, like you can double up each of those and it means something else too. You know, so if I say, instead of just ngal, us too, if I say ngal, ngal, I'm meaning it's up to us, you know. So there's, yeah, like only us kind of thing. And then it becomes a weird exclusive thing. So there's a lot of pronouns that we have. And it's funny because what I found was that all of these social roles described by these pronouns, they're actually, you see them in complexity theory. So every like node in a complex system, it behaves on these basic operating protocols that are patterned on like what Aboriginal language pronouns are. So when I discovered that, I was like, and it's amazing because our language is patterned on the landscape and on complex adaptive systems of, you know, ecosystems, etc. And so, you know, it has those patterns and those roles and can tell you who you're supposed to be. It's really exciting. Like it's hard though to come into this topic, hey? Because you like start to pick up one thread just to try and like dip your toe in. And then, you know, I've mixed my metaphors there. So I pull one thread and the whole web comes apart. I dip my toe in and the whole shark comes up and grab my leg. Anyway, either or both of those metaphors is fine.
But you see, now you've already said so much in your answer. You know, when I asked the question about how your point of view is us too, I mean, that's a relational point. You know, it immediately brings me in as the reader in relationship to you as what you're saying. It automatically engages me in doing something active. I felt much more active in reading this book than I do many other books. I mean, one reason being that it made me think so hard. It not only made me think so much, I mean, about different things, but it made me think hard because what are you thinking there?
it's just like, this is how lovely dialogue is. So I think we've just invented a theory that we might call something like relational passivity or something like that. Sorry, keep going. I'm just really excited about what you're saying.
So what you are saying is that you live in a culture which is defined by connectedness. And of course, the link of that to sustainability, which is, I think, the kind of meta thing that you're talking about, or the purpose of this book is really to talk about how do we think about ourselves and the world in a way that protects the world and recreates the world. It is that connectivity that is the basis of ecosystems thinking, right?
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, this is just what we're doing right now is a perfect little microcosm of what needs to happen. Like we have to be engaging in these relational dialogues and relational design processes where we haven't already predetermined the outcome, you know, based on our individual special brilliance, you know, because there is no individual special brilliance. No one's got a brain that's good enough to come up with a real solution to anything, you know. But us two together, you know, like all this, these sparks going back and forth. And you were saying even just the illusion of doing that in the book and that feeling of sitting down and actually, you know, creating that relationship, that us two, that it made you feel something. And the way you expressed it to me, just it made it sound like it was a good feeling and an uplifting, healing kind of feeling, you know.
It was. I mean, and it is. I can't even say it in the past tense. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tyson Yonkaporta, scholar and member of the Aboriginal Apalach Clan in Queensland, Australia. His book is Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. You know, one of the early things you talk about is the impossible physics of civilization. I mean, you know, we started this conversation where it's not just telling us about the aboriginal ways of being in the world, but of viewing civilization, quote unquote, through aboriginal eyes. So what are the impossible physics of civilization?
Yeah, well, I guess it's important to define civilization first, because everybody thinks they've got one. I mean, it's presented as a positive thing. And so, I mean, and a lot of people will say, well, it's any society that has laws, you know, it has law and order and makes bread and makes art is a civilization. Well, that just sounds like every human culture on the planet to me. And so, I mean, you could do that. You could just say everyone's, but I don't think that's what it is. A civilization is something, is a breakaway system that started about, you know, 12,000 years ago. And it's a system that, yeah, it basically denies the laws of physics, of give and take. It has this idea that you can take more than what there is. It's grounded in this narcissism, this sort of original sin thought of I am greater than. This idea that a person or people can put themselves above other people or place or any other being, you know, and say, I'm greater than this place exists to serve me. These people exist to serve me. So I guess it's that power need, that artificial power, you know, taking more than what is available. Yeah, so I guess that's what civilizations do. And there's an impossible physics to it. And I guess I get a bit more technically into it in the book. You know, I talk specifically about the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Yeah, that first law is where energy is neither created nor destroyed and moves between systems. I found out actually recently, physicists have worked out that energy can actually be destroyed and is eventually. It's a new discovery, like a recent one. But anyway, that first law is about these infinite interconnected overlapping systems, you know, where energy is transferred between systems constantly and therefore is always changing states and kind of recycling back through these systems. And it's passive because it's passing between different systems and then coming back into them. It's kind of like, you know, manure on the grass or something, you know, it's always recycled back through that animal. And in that system, it's moving between systems, you know, above and below ground, I guess in that same kind of way, you know. So that's that first law of thermodynamics. So I think of that as the first law of first peoples, you know, because that's how our time, the physics of our time and place are organized, you know, along those lines. I thought I was brilliant coming up with that. But then, like, after the book was published, I found out that Charles Darwin had said pretty much the same thing. So, yeah. So apparently I'm mates with Charles Darwin now. Anyway, yeah, the second law of thermodynamics is that in a closed system, things break down over time, basically, and that's what time makes time run straight.
So that's the idea of entropy. And so relate that now to what you talk about as indigenous pattern thinking.
Oh, sorry, hang on. I never answered the question. Just really quickly before I go to pattern thinking. So I guess basically civilized systems are entropic. Basically, a civilization is a community that can only exist by importing resources from elsewhere. That's your basic definition of a civilization. And the physics of it doesn't work. The math doesn't work. You end up with desert and everything wrecked. So you go back to the earliest civilizations, every single one of them is in desert. And you read about those same places just in the Bible, which happened like 5 minutes ago. And yeah, that wasn't desert before. It's bloody desert now, though. Anyway, pattern thinking.
Well, I mean, it relates to this because pattern thinking connection is opposed to this, the impossible physics of a civilization. You know, the civilization is, you call it artificial simplicity, infecting complex patterns. So it's the pattern thinking that is, if I have it right, is cyclical. It is about connection. And it's also about change, about constant change. So I would love if you could explain those concepts and how they relate to, you know, what we have to do now if we want to, you know, stop destroying our world and start protecting it.
Well, there's a difference between complex and complicated. So, you know, a complex system is dynamic, self-organizing system. Okay. And it can't be designed by a singular mind or even a group of minds. A complex system is not something that can be designed by anything but a complex system itself. You know, like a really, you know, a big complex system, it has to evolve or co-evolve. A complex system has to be in a co-evolutionary sort of iterative cycle, you know, and to develop out of complexity. It can't be designed. If you design a system, then that can never be complex. All it can be is complicated. So, for example, the machinery that we're using right now to communicate, it's complicated. So if I took that little fighting stick, my daughter's fighting stick I was telling you about before, and I stabbed it through this computer screen, that's it. That computer's stuffed. Like that has to be, I'd have to take that to the shop and they would have to fix it. So the screen would have to be replaced. But if I missed the computer and that stick went into my leg and it put a hole in my leg, then I don't have to go to the leg shop and get my leg cut off and replace the leg. You know, that's going to heal. That little dent in my leg, it's going to bleed out for a bit, but, you know, as long as I keep it covered, that's going to heal up. Because my body, and I don't have to do anything. You know, I don't have to look at the manual and go, oh, what's the pattern of all those cells there? I've got to put them all back together. No, that's my body's a self-organizing system. It's going to do that for me. And it's a self-organizing system because it's complex. This computer isn't because it's complicated. It's tinkered. You know, so the International Space Station, that's a complicated system. The fungus that's growing in it currently and destroying it, it is a complex system. It's complex and self-organizing to the point that every time they invent a new poison to try and kill it, then the fungus outsmarts that and like responds to the poison, adapts, grows stronger, and is currently taking over the International Space Station. And eventually they're all going to have to leave it and abandon it there in space.
Wow. I didn't even know that.
I guess an indigenous pattern thinking logic, looking at that, you know, for a starter, it makes you laugh. Like there's a lot of humor to be found there. But if you look at the process that it takes for an entire world of nations to develop something like that out of, to extract all the materials from that, okay, if you can use your pattern logic to imagine all of the supply chains that would feed into building that thing and then maintaining it, that's just massive scale destruction on the surface of the earth to produce and maintain that thing. I mean, massive destruction, unimaginable. A lot of people have had to die and be displaced from their lands in order for just the materials for that to be created. I mean, the rare earth metals alone for the computers that are communicating with it and that are on board, like just the rare earth metals, I mean, those have to be processed. You know, they have to be dug up and they're rare for a start. And they're usually found on like the land of poor people or indigenous people around the world. So those people have to be removed. And then they have to be dug up in a very energy intensive process. But then they have to be refined in the most toxic and radioactive process known to man. And then that radioactive waste has to be stored somewhere, usually on the lands of indigenous people or poor people. And, you know, they have to be stored for thousands of years. How long does a barrel last? I mean, I can't imagine more than a couple of hundred years. What's their plan? What's the long-term plan for the storage of all this stuff? There is no plan. They haven't factored that in. They haven't set aside the money in their budget for, you know, a 3,000 years of care while the half-life of this. So you start to see all those things and more, so many things. So you look at the economic systems that have to be set up. You look at the supply and demand things that happen and that are impacted with each of these things being produced. And, you know, the way that system can't be allowed to just be a complex adaptive system, but it has to be tinkered as well and made into a complicated system so that it can be controlled and monopolized and weighed in the favor of some rather than others, because we couldn't possibly allow it to just do what a natural system does and distribute the energy equally throughout the system. Oh my goodness, no. You know, it has to be tinkered. And so this tinkered monstrosity floating in space, which has grown out of this tinkered monstrosity of an economic system and a civilization that's destroyed the lives of and our habitat as human beings, it's there floating around in space. Eventually, all the radioactive waste is going to leak out of them barrels. And, you know, because we need those rare earth metals for our phones and our computers, and we're not going to stop. So eventually all that radioactive waste is going to leak out of the barrels, and it's basically going to make the entire world so radioactive that, you know, life as we know it is not going to be able to live here. However, on the bright side, centuries after the space station is abandoned, there's going to be this fungus out there growing in space. And what's in space? Radiation. So it's going to be being exposed to all these like quite high levels of radiation out in space for, you know, centuries. And we know how highly adaptive it is. So it's going to adapt to that. It's probably going to get bored there floating in space too. So it might, I don't know, learn to play chess or something. But eventually it's going to re-enter the atmosphere. And I don't know, because it's been out in that radiation for so long, maybe a bunch of spores will survive the burn up on re-entry. And then suddenly you've got a radiation-resistant life form that's just coming back onto this rock and repopulating it with, like, walking-talking mushrooms.
Yeah, in fact, there's a wonderful book and movie called Fantastic Fungi, I think is what it's called, which I just saw, which would be completely, would just love what you just said. It completely in the context of that wonderful movie. But so Tyson Yunkaporta, in this book, in Sand Talk, I want to kind of come back then to what you were just talking about and root it again in the Aboriginal experience. And so one thing I want to ask you about, which is something I've always wondered about and never quite understood, is song lines. What are they, and how do they embody the kind of learning and perspective that you've just been talking about?
Well, what's your understanding of ley lines from that Anglo-Celtic tradition?
I understand them as lines of power in energy, lines of energy in the earth.
And have you come across any ideas, any folklore associated with those ley lines as well? What you call folklore, fairy roads and all that sort of stuff. Have you come across that? I don't know how they say it, because I know I'm going to get it wrong anyway. So I'll just say feng shui. It's like, no, you can't put this house here. It's sitting right on the eye of a dragon. What are you doing? Yeah.
But I thought of the song lines, aren't they more than that? Aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But I'm just trying to tease out, like, I don't know. I just, because this is a dialogue, I just want to get your background knowledge, like what you have. And it must be there. Like, everybody knows this stuff. Like, indigenous knowledge, it's stuff that everybody knows, and it's just out of their grasp. And they've probably heard bits and pieces throughout their life that they haven't quite put together. Like, you would have heard of fairy rings and fairy roads and fairy dances. And then you would have heard of, like, the pathways of gods traveling. You might have heard about Alexander the Great following the pathway of Dionysius when he originally, during the act of creation, traveled out from where India was. And he was basically following that road to find India. So the more you dig around in these ideas, these little superstitions and lovely little traditions and rituals around ley lines in the Anglo-Celtic tradition and feng shui in the Chinese tradition, and anywhere around the world that you see these sorts of things, when you start to dig around in those, you start to see clues. You start to see, oh, these are usually attached to acts and moments and stories of creation. And at some stage, creator beings were walking or moving or burrowing or swimming along these paths or flying, and that the action of their movements through the landscape actually created these song lines, these lines of energy. And these lines of energy remain networked across the landscape, latticed everywhere, like a big web. But that each line can be sung, and it can be sung as a story, you know. So these are narrative. So landscape is story, and landscape is music, and landscape is knowledge. And it is thus because of song lines. So song lines is just the English word for them, you know, because it was, that was the part that they focused on. Because I guess anthropologists were interested in these. I don't know, there was a romantic, like, you know, you'd see an old guy walking along, singing a song, you know, like a GPS to find his way. You know, so I suppose that, that was exciting to people. But it's more than that. You know, it's visual and it's maps drawn in the sand, thus the idea of sand talk. You know, sand talk is a way of conveying knowledge by drawing images in the sand. But these song lines are, you know, these are visual. You know, these are visual inner maps that you have in your mind as a kind of bird's eye view of landscape. And as you probably notice with most Aboriginal art that you see will be almost like a bird's eye view of a landscape, because that's what these things are. So these dreamings, you know, they stretch right across the landscape. And it's your cognition, your being, everything, your body, your understanding of the world, your way of governing, your way of living, your way of being a custodian of different bioregional ecosystems, all these things are sung into the landscape. And these stories interconnect like perfectly and give you a roadmap of how to live in the world, how to be. They give you warnings of what to be careful of. And pretty much all of them end up close to their beginning or somewhere along the line, warn you against that narcissism, that assumption that you are better than someone else or something else, that you are above anyone else. Because this is, you know, our entire culture, every part of it, as with any sustainable culture, it has to be something that it's built to suppress, to contain the excesses of narcissism. Any system that is going to last with human beings in it has to be something that has a way of curtailing the excesses of narcissists.
Tyson Yunkaporta. We'll talk more with him about his book Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World, after the break. That was Australian Aboriginal musician David Hudson. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. We're spending the hour today talking with Tyson Yunkaporta, scholar and member of the Aboriginal Apalach Clan in Queensland, Australia. His book is Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. Just before the break, Yunkaporta was saying that any sustainable system of human organization has to have a way of curtailing narcissism, the idea that some are entitled to have it all while others have nothing. I've always thought of myself as an anarchist in the sense of believing in the democratic self-organization of people. And that is very much what you describe here. And in fact, You know, I remember a long time ago reading a book about, I think it was by Marshall Solins, and it was about tribal cultures and made the point that the 99% of human history, we lived in these democratic, self-organized bands where everyone was basically equal and chieftains were only chiefs or leaders as long as they could demonstrate that they had the capacity for leadership. And as soon as they lost that, they were done.
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's a bit of a, I don't know, I do address in the book quite a bit of the myths of primitivism and a lot of the Paleolithic sort of misconceptions, that story, that survival of the fittest story that's been mapped over our past, over most of human history. Yeah, we've really been lied to about that. And I guess it's really thoughtfully engaging with Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous communities over time where you'll find that lie, where you'll expose it and try and start to get an idea of a pattern of what actually was. Yeah. I mean, just I mentioned before that this misconception that men were the hunters and women were the gatherers, that's caused a lot of damage in the world, that idea. You know, everything that we have, these notions of the fittest survive, you know, the chief is the one who's the best fighter and he only gets to be chief for as long as he's stronger than everyone else. And then someone else will come up and kill him and then he'll take over. Always a he for some reason, you know. There was I read a book, Lier Keith, I think her name was. She's a radical feminist writer from over there in the States. And she was talking about the way these little bone discs that they were digging up in the floors of caves from Paleolithic sites, all around, archaeology sites all around the world, they kept finding these bone discs with notches around the outside of the circle. And no matter where it was, they always seemed to have the same, roughly the same kind of number. You know, it was always between about, you know, 26 and 31 kind of notches around the outside of the thing. Now, what could these have been for? What could they have been for? And no one could figure it out because they hadn't had any female, they hadn't had any female archaeologists yet. And like your first intern who didn't have a penis coming into that site, she goes, yeah, I know what that is. She's like controlling her fertility and like counting the days and trying to figure out when she needs to do this intervention to make sure she's going to have or not have this child. You know, it's fantastic. So she's regulating her cycle there. And it's like, no, that can't be possible. They weren't sophisticated enough. They were just like randomly walking around like animals, like raping each other and smashing each other over the head. Surely, no. Yeah. I don't know. I think Western culture opened itself up to the idea of sophisticated Paleolithic lifestyles when that genome project sort of showed that that Europeans are basically Neanderthals, are all descended from Neanderthals. And it was like suddenly it was a few weeks. Like that story came out and then there was just this silence. And a few weeks later, like this spate of stories came out. You can see actually we're discovering that Neanderthals were actually really really quite advanced, you know, sophisticated people. and so they let go of a lot of things. Like they suddenly trotted out these bones that they must have been keeping in a cupboard somewhere, you know, where it's like, look, we've got like a 70-year-old dude who was born disabled, so he couldn't even walk. We got the bones of him. So A, they must have been caring for disabled people. So they must have had quite abundant food and they must have been caring for each other. They also must have had really good medicine because we've got these fracture patterns in the bones that are like rodeo clowns. So they must have been able to heal fractures really quickly. They're drilling holes in the skull to like let pressure out after they've had a head wound and then living afterwards. So they had surgery. So they, you know, talked about all these things and went, wow. But they ignored some things though. So they brushed over, you know, the fact that men and women had the same fracture patterns that could only come from hunting. They ignored that because that's a sacred cow. you know, men are hunters and women are gatherers is a sacred cow, and you don't want to mess with that. So, you know, even though male and female skeletons had the same hunter fracture patterns, it's like, no, we're going to ignore that. So, you know, they're really gradually coming around. I guess, you know, narcissism is a hard thing to hack your way through.
Yes, we know that here in this country, having one of the prime specimens of that as our president.
Isn't he just a little specimen? Yeah. A magnificent man. He must have been like, yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, he's a prime example of manhood, that one. It's only the fittest and the strongest surviving there. I tell you, it must be those bloodlines. There's like superior, awesome, eugenics-inspired bloodlines to produce such a magnificent specimen, a magnificent beast.
This is Writer's Voice. We're talking with Tyson Yonkaporta. His book is Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. You know, you have different constructs in the book, which was part of me thinking hard. So you talk about five different ways of thinking in the Aboriginal way of thinking. So kinship mind, story mind, dreaming mind, ancestor mind, and pattern mind. Could you put those together for us and explain their interrelationship, what they are in their interrelationship?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, they're not things that are named or even separated, you know, in our culture. But they're just, I mean, yeah, you're right to call them constructs, because really they're just ways in to be able to understand an Indigenous worldview, you know, so they're kind of digestible chunks that a person could come in and see those things and experience them and begin to immerse themselves in a way of knowing and being in the world, which is basically just how we're designed to know and be as human beings in this world. You know, we are organisms, we are animals, and we do have a habitat, and habitats are constantly changing, and we're supposed to adapt and change and move with that habitat and be shaped by it in our language and speech. But in order to live like that, there are certain ways of thinking and ways of being and knowing that you need to be embodying, not just learn or know about. You have to embody these things. So I guess these five things, and I challenge people to actually try and put them all together into one thing and to imagine what that looks like. So these five things, yeah, like I said, there's that kinship mind, I vaguely call it. I don't want to call these things anything, because I don't want people to bloody TM, I want people to go and think about it and build their own way based on their own place, their own bioregion and culture of where they are, put their own things together and call them or not call them, you know, in their own language way from that place. Like, I don't want to put this thing on it that's, oh, yeah, this is Tyson Yonkaporta's bloody mind thing way or whatever, you know, brand it, IP it, bloody whatever. I don't like that. This is just open source. You just have a play with it. But anyway, you got that kinship mind. It's that everything's, that nothing exists on its own. Everything exists in relation to something else is the basic central concept of that. So it's basically, you know, everything that you look at is in a context, in a relational context with other things and a field around it, including yourself. So there's no such thing as objectivity. Everything's going to be subjective. Everything's going to be, you know, from your standpoint, you and the people around you that you're related to. You're part of a field that's observing itself. So there you go. That sorts out the uncertainty problem there.
And story mind?
Story mind is basically you're building, it's what we're doing, the us two thing that we were talking about before. It's dialogical sort of sharing of narratives, you know, sitting together alongside each other, sharing those stories. So basically, I think I'd say something like, you know, like a story is just, it's something to put children to sleep. But if you want to be awake and grown, then you have to have a dialogical sharing of stories, which I call a yarn. You know, it's You know, stories don't mean anything until they come alongside someone else's stories. And you're seeing, you know, from that point of view as well, because it forms something else in the aggregate. When you get lots of stories together in the aggregate, that's where the truth starts to emerge, you know?
And so I want to ask, I guess I want to finish on what you talk about in the latter part of the book, Tyson Yunkaporta, in Sand Talk, which is, you talk about kind of the four principles of relating in a way that can protect the earth. And I don't know if you even use that word protect. You use a different word.
I talk about us being a custodial species.
Custodians. That says that we're a custodial species. And so you talk about respect, connect, reflect, and direct. And so tell us about that, those words, those concepts within the context of us being a custodial species, of how we need to act with each other and the earth to be able to do that.
You know, I guess these complicated systems have been developed using exactly those same four steps, but in reverse. So, you know, the hero comes into the space and directs change. This singular individual, this person who has this amazing understanding and knowledge and strength and capacity and moral superiority and all the rest and spiritual superiority, comes into a context and tries to, you know, build order from chaos. So that's the first step, direct. And it doesn't work. It all goes wrong. You know, it just Columbuses into a big mess. And so the next step then, I guess, is reflect. So it's direct and then reflect and sitting down, head in hands, thinking what the hell went wrong, you know, and all right, we better crunch the numbers. We better check the data, try and figure out where the hell this went wrong. And that's usually at the point where people realize, well, we probably missed a step, and that's connect. We should have formed relationships, and we probably should have understood how things were connected across this system, all the connections and the lines of communication and energy exchange and things like that first before we came in and just started directing change, because we're kind of messed it up now. So we'll do that now. We'll start making these relationships. And then finally arriving at the point of respect. So it's kind of like, you know, oh my goodness, you know, the wisdom of this culture is amazing. You know, we're going to put a quote from that on a poster with a picture of one of the elders, and we're going to put it on the door of our toilet, because that really feeds my soul. I feel so much respect for this culture. I'm going to buy a dream catcher. That's amazing. So, you know, it goes, it's kind of like this reversal of the process. It goes, you know, direct, reflect, connect, respect. A sustainable way forward is simply to reverse that, to start with respect, because that's the work of your spirit. And then you can begin to connect, to build relationships, and that's the work of your heart. So respect, connect, and then reflect. Reflect, that's your the work of your head. And you don't do that on your own. You do that in us twos, from the relationships that you made in the former step. You do that in your us twos and in your us's, all your other us's, your exclusive groups, you know, just women, you know, or just men, or just young people, just old people, you know, just people who speak this language, etc. But then in the bigger us's, where all of those exclusive groups interact and come together, because you need that diversity. You need diverse things interacting. So what have you done? You've respected, connected, and reflected. And in reflecting, you're building the theory and the bodies of knowledge collectively that you need to move forward as custodians of this reality, as a custodial species, and to act properly in perfect ways in that place. And that leads you to the final step, which is direct. So direct is the work of your hands as you actually act on the world around you. That's when you build or make or do. And that's the correct sequence. If you come in straight away with the work of the hands and you start to build destroy, cut down, dig up. It all goes the wrong way. I guess it's all these exceptional individuals and exceptional groups of people who believe in their exceptionalism, which kind of have messed things up and reversed that process somewhat.
Well, Tyson Yunkaporta, it has been really, really such a privilege to talk with you about your book, Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely.
Tyson Yunkaporta is an academic, an arts critic, and a researcher who belongs to the Apalach clan in far north Queensland. He carves traditional tools and weapons and also works as a senior lecturer in Indigenous knowledges at Deakin University in Melbourne. Read an excerpt from Sand Talk at writersvoice.net. And you can also listen to him read a wonderful guided meditation from Sand Talk. Well, it turns out we've got about 9 minutes left on the show. So I dug into my archives and found an interview I did in 2018 for a local news program with Paul Greenberg, author of The Omega Principle. I spoke with him just before the airing of a PBS Frontline documentary, The Fish on My Plate, inspired by Greenberg's book, The Omega Principle. The documentary, like the book, looks at sustainable fishing and aquaculture. Here's an excerpt from that interview. So you talked with Brent Smith of Greenway Farms. He farms in Thimble Islands, Connecticut, around the Thimble Islands. He said something very interesting. He said that we're running Iowa pig farms in the ocean. What did he mean by that?
So Brent was talking about aquaculture or fish farming as it's practiced in many industrial settings today. It's his belief that we've basically turned salmon into large-scale farmed animals much in the way we've done with pigs or with cattle, the only difference being that it's relatively recent. Salmon farming is really only about 40 or 50 years old. But, you know, when you farm animals on an industrial scale, as we've done with pigs and with cows, you're using the environment as a way of processing a lot of the wastes that come out of those farms. So we've all heard about those, you know, horrible lagoon ponds that often pool up behind cattle confined animal feeding operations. The concern with aquaculture with farmed fish today is that while there are no lagoon ponds, you are growing fish in the open ocean within a net, but all the waste that comes out of the farm is going into the marine environment. So, you know, there's that, and you know, there have been issues of antibiotic use in farmed salmon. It's actually starting to curb somewhat, at least in Norway, where we were for the Frontline film. They're really not using a lot of antibiotics anymore. They're tending to inoculate fish against disease rather than pump them full of antibiotics as they might have done in the past. So, you know, when Bren looks at modern aquaculture and calls them Iowa pig farms, I think he's bringing to mind the worst of fish farming. And we have to also look at what Bren is doing. He's farming oysters, mussels, and kelp, and those are three organisms that actually don't require inputs at all. You don't have to feed them. You don't have to give them water. You don't even have to inoculate them against any diseases. They filter the water, make the water cleaner, and in the process produce pretty high omega-3 food for us. So it's kind of a win-win situation.
Yeah, it's a terrific farming operation. But when you say that, for example, you just mentioned Norway. You do go to Norway there, and there is a salmon war going on. They may not be using antibiotics, but the waste issue is still a problem.
It is. There are, you know, I think one of the characters in the film notes that the salmon farms that are along the coast are producing more waste than the entire human population of the city of Bergen. So that immediately raises concerns about, are you putting too many nitrates into the water? Is it causing algal blooms, which when they die potentially could cause dead zones, you know, hypoxic areas where water, oxygen has been literally sucked out of the water. But they're also concerned because And this is probably the biggest concern in Norway right now, is that because salmon farming has grown and because there are more and more aggregations of these farms all up and down the fjords of Norway, it's attracted a parasite called a sea louse. It's a sea louse are a creature that cling onto the outside of farmed salmon, and they suck the blood and tissues out of the salmon. And they can be a risk for wild salmon that might be migrating through those farmed salmon pens. The industry has tried to counter the sea lice infestation. They've used a chemical called Slice, which is a shell inhibitor, which sounds great. You know, it gets rid of those sea lice and we won't have a problem. But the problem that happens is that Slice does have residues that will end up in the sediment below the salmon farms. And in addition, because it's a shell disruptor, there are actually shrimp fisheries in the Norwegian fjords. And if shrimp are exposed to Slice, they also will suffer the inability to form shells. And so while you might be saving the farmed salmon by using an anti-lice chemical, you could also potentially be damaging a wild shrimp fishery. So, you know, this all comes back to an overarching theme in the film and in my work, which is that I am not anti-aquaculture, I'm not anti-farming of seafood, but we need to figure out a way of doing it in which we end up with a net gain in marine protein. In other words, we don't want to kill other fish, so other wild fish, so we can get wild farm fish on our plate. We don't want to feed too many wild fish to farmed fish so that we can get more farmed fish on our plate. So if we can come up with a net gain of marine protein for us through farming, I'm all for it. But if we can't, then we really have to think our methodologies through.
Yes, and you do feature some pretty exciting ways of doing that. Talk about the Blue Circle farms. Yes. up in the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, and we visited a farm in Kvaroy, a little island the far north of Norway, and they're doing some interesting things. For example, when you grow salmon, generally you have to feed them fish meal or fish oil, and often that meal and oil is coming from wild fish, usually from Peruvian anchoveta, which we also look at in the film. What they're doing in Kvaroy, instead of feeding wild fish to their fish, they're actually taking, they're still using wild fish, but they're actually using discards, things that would just have gotten thrown away from other food fish fisheries. So they catch a lot of herring that the Norwegians eat, and it's a very popular fish in Norway, but you can't eat all of it, the guts, the bones, and so forth. That portion of the herring catch, they grind up, and they feed that to salmon. So it's a maximalization of the resources of the ocean, which I think, again, is a good thing. They're also doing interesting things. They have this extremely cute fish, and if you go to my Twitter feed, which is just at 4fishgreenberg, number 4fishgreenberg, you'll see a picture I just posted of the lump sucker, which is a fish that literally picks the sea lice off of the salmon and eats them, and it's almost like the salmon go into these kind of artificial kelp fields that the farm has created where the lump suckers are, and it's almost like a car wash where the lump suckers come out, clean the lice off, and the salmon goes about its business. So it's, again, a win-win situation where you don't have to use toxic chemicals to get rid of the lice. You're using a natural predator to get rid of them, which in my mind is, you know, more optimistic towards achieving eventually a balanced system.
Paul Greenberg talking about the PBS Frontline documentary inspired by his book, The Omega Principle. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.